The following is a production of Art Trap Productions, brought to you by the Gallifreyan Embassy and has been made possible by supporting subscribers and donations from listeners like you. This episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audiblepodcast.com/arttrap. That's ARTTRAP. Over 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. This episode also brought to you by Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy. Check out their website at dlair.net. That's D as in dragon, lair.net. Live while being strapped in for decontamination, it's Doctor Who Podshock.
Doctor Who Podshock.
Okay, well, let's do it now. Whatever it is, if it's valuable, send it to us.
For the best in all things Doctor Who, it's Doctor Who Podshock, the podcast all about Doctor Who, the longest-running science fiction television program, with Louis Trapani.
Hello.
Ken Deep.
Hello.
James Norton.
Hello.
News.
Fabulous.
Reviews.
Oh, no.
And fan mail for James.
40,000.
Doctor Who Podshock, from the Gallifreyan Embassy.
You know, that guy James was really cool. Oh, yeah, we blew that.
I'm the Doctor, and who are you?
The Gallifreyan Embassy, celebrating 25 years, presents Doctor Who Podshock, episode 206. This is Louis Trapani, and this is our live show reviewing Cold Blood. As always, if you have not seen this episode of Doctor Who yet, please wait until you have before venturing any further for spoilers, because there will be spoilers here. And this episode's going out a little late on our feeds, and we're just about to record our live show for Vincent and the Doctor. In past years, Eurovision would interfere with the schedule of Doctor Who and maybe postpone an episode, and this year they did not. And we probably could have used that postponement just to catch up with everything that's going on. We just released a extra edition of Doctor Who Podshock 205 that's out on the feeds now. In addition to this episode of Doctor Who Podshock, we have another one following on its heels before we get to our live review of Vincent and the Doctor. So it's a busy time here at Doctor Who Podshock, but without any further delay, let's go to our review of Cold Blood, which we recorded live on Memorial Day weekend, in the U.S. at least.
This is the story of our planet, Earth, of the day a thousand years passed when we came to share it with the race known as humanity.
Decontamination complete. Commencing dissection.
Area 17 insertion.
Yeah, and stay out!
Did you hear that? You never picked a lizard man's pocket.
It's my son.
He's still alive.
We find weapons. Get that creature from the lab and force it to release Elliot, yeah?
Yeah. We'll get him out.
The doctor will get your son back, I promise. We take turns guarding the creature.
Oh, so that's it? We just sit and wait?
And then we exchange her for your family.
I'm decontaminating now.
How does it feel, Ape?
Like it's burning in my blood. If you could cure me, I could help you escape.
Why would I want to escape when I can watch you die?
I'm only neutralizing all your ape bacteria.
I'm not an ape. Look at the scans. Two hearts. Totally different. Totally not ape! Remove all human germs. You remove half the things keeping me alive.
No, complete the process.
That's much better, thanks. Not got any celery, have you? Who are you?
Restak, military commander.
Oh, dear, really? There's always a military, isn't there?
Your weapon was attacking the oxygen pockets above our city.
Oxygen pockets? Lovely. Ooh, but not so good with an impending drill.
Amy, what are you doing? Get out of there!
Some sort of suspended animation. I wonder what these are.
I've got it. It's how they came out to the surface. Some sort of powered transport discs.
These must be the only ones awake. Their astronomers predicted the planet heading to Earth on a crash course. They built a life underground and put themselves to sleep for millennia in order to avert what they thought was the apocalypse, when in reality, it was the moon coming into alignment with the Earth.
How can you know that?
Long time ago, I met another tribe of Homo reptilia.
What have you done?
She kept taunting me about Mo and Elliot and you.
knew this would come. And soon the war.
This is our court and our place of execution.
Let them go.
Amy.
Pond, there's a girl to rely on.
You're covered both ways, so don't try anything clever. Now let them go, or I shoot. I'm warning you.
Don't you touch her!
All right, Reztac. You've made your point.
This is now a military tribunal. Prepare them for execution.
The Gallifreyan Embassy, celebrating 25 years of time and space, presents Doctor Who Podshock. This is Louis Trapani, and, well, not joining me today is Dave Cooper, and, and well, hopefully Ken Deep and James Norton will be joining us later, but mid-show, let's hope. I'm assuming maybe Ken might be at work. But we are going forward with our review of Cold Blood, which is the continuation of The Hungry Earth, which we reviewed last week. So this picks up where we left off last time with The Hungry Earth. So I have to say that we, I was saying before the show that this was the, this recording is taking place during the holiday weekend in the U.S., Memorial Day weekend. And I can't speak for the whole country, but here in New York, the weather is gorgeous and everyone's out with their barbecues and doing their Memorial Day activities. So it's probably going to be an on-time show, perhaps, today, which is what, you know, it is. So let's get on with the show. Also, it must be noted that because of Memorial Day weekend, BBC America, to my knowledge, did not have a airing last night, did not transmit an episode of Doctor Who. So now the U.S. and to my understanding, Canada as well, the Space Channel, are going to be 3 weeks behind the U.K. in BBC in Doctor Who, in the new Doctor Who series. Yeah, bummer. It's also because of BBC America delay, it delays everything else as well, because the live streaming of and also the downloading, the renting, and whatever, the digital downloads of Doctor Who are also delayed because, for instance, like, it's not in iTunes where it would normally be today. I guess it would be Amy's Choice episode would be there today, and now that's being delayed another week. Yeah, not good for North America. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get on with our review of Cold Blood. Now, I got to thank Dave Cooper for that montage that you just heard before. Even though he's not in today's show, he did prepare those clips, as he always does, and we are always ever so grateful for Dave for his work that he does. And thank you, Dave. It's a continuation of last week's story. So once again, it's written by Chris Chibnall. It's directed by Ashley Way. And we pick up this story with, we see the Earth. It's a shot of the Earth, and there's narration. And I wasn't expecting that because it wasn't in The Hungry Earth. And I don't know, it felt a little out of place, I have to say. It was, you know, after seeing the whole story, I just felt the whole narration there was unneeded. It felt tacked on. And as I said, it wasn't in The Hungry Earth. And I think the story would have survived just as well without it. You know, I just, if anything, it was a distraction. And it's telling you stuff that it's already, the stuff that's, you don't need to know because it's already in the story. It's already represented on screen. So I don't think it added anything to it, but so have you. But that's really probably one of my only negatives of this story. I think it's, I think it kind of delivers on what it was promised in our last episode. Everything was sort of building up to this, but just some technical points, the underground design that we see here with the in the Silurian city, I thought was done very well. It had the lighting was done very well, nice golden lights, and I thought just the scenery was handled very well. It wasn't one of those, you know, typical barren caves, dreadful, why would anyone want to live there type of thing. So I think they did a good job in doing something a little bit different. It was clear it was underground, but it wasn't so typical that we see so often and elsewhere when we see underground locations. So I thought they did a good job with that, considering what they had to work with and budgetary constraints and all that. Another little niblet that you heard in that clip was the the reference to celery, which I thought was a nice little touch there. Nothing that will alienate anyone that may not have been following the series from way back when, but I thought it was just a nice little nod there to the Fifth Doctor. Another little nitpick I might have is the use of Homo Reptilia. Homo Reptilia. If you're going to use that, why not also use Homo Sapien as well? It just seemed a little out of place where it was humans versus Homo Reptilia. And I just thought if you're going to use Homo Reptilia, use Homo Sapien as well and just be consistent. Whatever. Again, I'm nitpicking. I just thought it was a good story. I felt it was very familiar. It was just had it, in the sense that The Beast Below was for me. It didn't seem like it felt like it was more of a nod to other works that we've seen before, more so than we've seen this 1,000 times. It had a familiar feel to it. It's interesting focus on the military of the Silurians, that military, the force that was awakened, and I just lost her name, the leader who was basically in charge of preserving the sleeping Silurians. And it was somewhat of a reverse to what we saw originally in 1970 in the first story with the Silurians, you know, where UNIT was the force to be reckoned with, and they were threatening the Silurians, and now the Silurians seemed to be more of a threat to humanity in this story than humans. So, I have to say that watching this story, I was beginning to really like the Rory character. It seemed like it was finally hitting home with me, where he was really coming into his own. And, you know, not that I disliked him before, I just felt that it just... He was more two-dimensional than three-dimensional. It's not the fault of the actor. It just wasn't enough screen time. It was just warming up to him and just getting to know him. And, all that came to naught at the end. But interesting. We'll see what happens. Is Rory really dead and forgotten? I don't know. We'll see. Again, with going back to the rip, the crack in time, or the rip, or whatever you want to call it, they had a few flashbacks to past stories that I don't know if it was needed. I mean, if you're watching this story maybe in the future out of order, they're good to have in there, but anyone that has been following the series, well, I guess some people miss episodes. Us Doctor Who fans catch every episode, so I don't think again, just a nitpick. I didn't think they were necessary, but I guess for viewers that may not have needed a reminder, perhaps, or may not have seen everything, they, I guess, added something to it. But I know they had a scene which was from either one of the Angel stories, where the Doctor said, explained that if you go into the crack, you'll never exist again. And then Amy says it right again in the TARDIS herself, so didn't really need that scene explaining about the light and disappearing and not being forgotten and all that. So I'm going to give it, I would like to give it, you know, a full 5, but I can't. I'm going to give it 4. Maybe if it didn't have that little narration stuff, which I thought was unneeded, maybe 4.5. Like I said, the story seemed familiar, but in a comfortably familiar feeling to it. It just seemed reminiscent to stories that I've seen in the past, but there was nothing in it that was completely took me off guard I wish I could say, oh, well, if it only had this, I would give it 5 or whatever, but it wasn't just, it just felt like there was something there that was missing that could have pushed it to 5. Can't say what it was. So we're going to get to people in the queue here. I think first up here is Darth Skeptical. So let's hear from Darth. Hello, Darth, and happy Memorial Day.
And to you, sir.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's not yet really kicked into the bulk of my Memorial Day yet, because it's not quite there.
Neither have I.
You know, so we still have plenty of time for barbecues later. They're really... Every weekend is a barbecue weekend here. But anyway, moving on. Yeah, you know, I think I said last week that this is... the first part was a thing that sort of split my mind between
mm-hmm. the old somebody Doctor who's a fan and
old Doctor Who and new Doctor Who fan. And I, you know, unfortunately, I think that, well, I say unfortunately, but I don't know, but the result of the two-parter doesn't change that opinion. I think that this is an absolutely fine episode. If you started out with Rose and you're coming through, I don't think that you're going to have that many problems with it, you know, on its own. Its own internal integrity is pretty tight. There are some little problems with the plot. If you just look at these two episodes, one of the biggest might be, one niggle might be where Amy comes into the Senate chamber or whatever and says, and is carrying a gun, and the doctor seems completely happy with that and doesn't admonish her for having that gun. And I think, you know, you might think, well, that's a little bit bad because really you spent the whole first episode saying how there must be another way.
Yeah.
And yet when it's your companion with a gun, then you're completely happy. So I was a little disturbed by that.
No, it's a good point because it seemed a little, now that you bring it up, it seems a little out of character to the rest of the story.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm of two minds about that particular scene and the particular way that Matt Smith delivers it, because it is the first time that he definitely knows that she's alive.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason that he has such a happy tone in his voice is because he, you know, has been absent from her. And so he's quite relieved to see her. And it may be a very secondary thing in his mind that she's carrying a gun.
Well, also,
but still.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say also the fact that perhaps he knows her so well that he knows that she's not going to use it, but it's a great distraction because he needed something at that point.
That's a good point, too. I mean, you know, it is a minor thing, but it's still, when I first saw it, I was like, wait a minute. He should have at least said, you know, nice to see you, but put down the gun or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Minor thing. But, you know, the integrity of the episode in and of itself is pretty good. I think that most people will have enjoyed it. I definitely think that this was overall a better reinvention of a classic series monster than, you know, Cybermen for sure.
Yeah.
Certainly than the Santarans. And, you know, it's at least on a par with Dalek in terms of bringing back a monster, giving us the basic idea of what that monster is, and leaving open the door for future stories with them. So it accomplishes its goal. I think you run into bigger problems if you're, again, looking at it in terms of the old series. I think you're quite right to say that it is somewhat of a reverse of Silurians, but that just means that, and we're talking there about Doctor Who and the Silurians, the 1970 original episode.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's just the reverse, that means it's just a copy, to my mind.
Yeah.
And I really thought last week that particular episode reminded me, you know, plot point, taken straight from Malcolm Hulk's script. And I really thought that this week we were going to get something radically different, and we didn't really. I mean, at the end of the day, Ambrose is the Brigadier. The Silurian scientist is the Silurian scientist. And so it's pretty much point for point what you got before. And you know, a part of my brain says, well, this is cueing a little too closely to that original story. But yet, you kind of have to do the original story again if you're going to bring it to a new audience, because the Silurians are not an A-profile returning villain, really. I mean, if you know the series, you know the Silurians. But if you're only a casual viewer, you really only got Cybermen and Daleks. And so you've got to do something to, I don't know, reintroduce them. So
do you think they're going to be coming back again? Or, I mean, because.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing, I think that they will be coming back because they've invested too much money in prosthetics and have figured out a way to do it, you know. But I think here's where narration part really lets you down, because, to me, to my mind, because it sets the parameters of what's possible. You know, it's saying 1,000 years from now we woke up and, you know, we established peace with the humans. And I think that is unfortunate that we know what the end was at the very beginning of the episode.
Yeah.
I mean, not only does it... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I just felt that whole narration was just unneeded. It just felt tacked on. It didn't seem like it gave you anything that you know, you needed to know. I think you could have just drawn those conclusions, or a lot of that stuff was in the story. But yeah, what you're saying is right, too. I mean, why bother saying that, you know? It
really does make it so that the next time we see them, it's almost got to be 1,000 years later.
Yeah.
And that, you know, maybe that's fine. Maybe he's got some grand plan where that makes sense, that you actually do want to have these bookend episodes. Who knows? But it does seem to me to be an unnecessarily limiting thing at this point. I don't know. We'll see how it plays out. And at the end of the day, you've got all that hocus pocus at the end of the episode, wherein time is going to be rewritten in some way that's major. Mm-hmm. And so let's skip ahead to that, the end of the episode, because that really doesn't wash with me. I mean, that's not, I don't think that most of that stuff is the fault of Chris Chibnall. I think that that's all Moffat season long stuff, and I don't understand it. I really don't get it at all.
I mean, you're talking about the
Death of Rory.
Death of Rory, or whatever his
what's the time crack? Yeah,
because
that
we
whole
know,
thing. Because it,
we know sorry. Somehow. Well, if that's the piece of the TARDIS, we know that, you know, the Doctor Who's not going to continue without a TARDIS. So you know somehow right. that's going to have to be put to right. And is Rory coming back? And so that's why that whole Rory scene at the end, I didn't really. I mean, I felt. I mean, I thought Karen Gillan did a great job, and the act that plays Rory Darvill. Did a great job. Darvill, whatever.
Darvill.
Yes, thank you. And but I didn't really feel anything because I figured, well, you know, I just felt okay. Well, this is just going to be a short absence of Rory before he comes back at the season finale.
Yeah. Now it's interesting because I thought. I didn't see it coming. I didn't see that any kind of death like that coming. And I thought that it was very effective to have him be killed off. But where you run into problems, I think, is the whole nature of the time crack and what it does to people who are caught within it. Because it seems quite different than what we got in Flesh and Stone. Because there, you know, if you walk into it, or at least Amy's reaction to somebody walking into it is that she still remembers them, but remembers that they have been taken. Mm-hmm. Now, here, she's not going to remember Rory. And the Doctor gives us this really glib line of, oh, it. The reason is because he's important to your personal timeline. It's like, well, that's dumb. Because those soldiers are also in her personal timeline. They also affect what she does. So you're saying that this time crack has the ability to filter out degrees of importance that, you know, if you've got a ring on your finger, that makes it more important than somebody who was protecting your life in a forest where you could have been killed. I don't know. When I heard it, I was like, that's crap. I mean, it really doesn't make any sense to me, the explanation that we were given. And it's sad because, as you said, the scene is played really well. I mean, amazing sort of acting, really, from Gillan and Smith in that whole scene. And I loved the scene, and I didn't really think about the implications of it till a little bit later. And then I was like, oh, man, that's a great scene, but it doesn't really mean anything. And like you say, it immediately points out the fact that there has to be a reset button. Somewhere, somehow, there is a reset button. And not only that, but for the period of time where things are not reset, then there's this lingering question of how does any of this season make sense now? Because if Rory's taken out of time, he's not on hand to, for instance, in part one of this story, help the Doctor collect a Silurian. He is not, you know, Vampires in Venice. There is no impetus for that story even having taken place at all. Mm. The entire series really now is in a state of massive flux.
Well, and I guess I don't know the Doctor's timeline. So for him, those things did occur, and just like the Doctor obviously remembers the Daleks, but Amy didn't.
I guess. And then, you know, that indeed, this is probably the explanation for why she doesn't remember things, because somehow Rory is important to everything, and we're going to find out, you know, whatever. That he, somehow this is at, obviously at the source of why Amy doesn't know that much about 2010, according to what we believe it is from the last 4 years of watching Doctor Who. Fine. But I think when we get to the end of this series, this notion of Rory being taken away is going to still leave us totally perplexed. It's not going to make a lot of sense. I think Moffat's going to try his best, but at the end of the day, it really doesn't make any sense within just this one story. If you take Rory out of the equation, okay, the Doctor remembers that there was a Rory, but the event still took place in a different way because he wasn't there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's really parallel universe, just so incredibly complicated now that the integrity of the season isn't there anymore. And I really do wonder whether they're going to be able to clear that up. But, you know, that's just the last 5 minutes, and there's still time for that to make sense. And we can hope that somehow in the next four episodes, and really specifically in the next, you know, the last two of those four, that it's going to make some sense. But until then, all we really have is, you know, the main bulk of the story about the Silurians and whether that was any good. And I think generally it was. I mean, as you said, it did deliver on the sort of slow buildup that we got in episode one. It gave us something that was nice, that was action-packed. You know, the moment, you can really feel the tension in this episode. The direction's good for that, you know, because you can feel the instant that the winds change.
Yes.
And suddenly, you know, there were points at which I was really feeling stress, you know, especially the whole business of are they going to kill Amy or not. That was very cleverly done, and might have been a better cliffhanger than what actually was the cliffhanger last week.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I mean, the basic story here was quite good and a nice reinvention for the species. It possibly gives us some interesting places to go. It also possibly gives us nothing interesting at all to do with them. Very tricky knowing what the future of this race and our relationship to them actually is. So I really do want them to return, though. Absolutely want them to return, much more so than Cybermen or Daleks or anything like that. This is definitely, again, for me, the best reinvention of a species since 2005.
Well, it's odd that, I mean, the Silurians are so much, if you're a Doctor Who fan, they're ingrained in Doctor Who folklore, but if you're a casual fan, they're not really, they were only in, what, really two episodes, if you count the Sea Devils, three of the series. So it's interesting if they're now going to utilize them now more than they had in the past.
It would be great. You know, now that they've developed the prosthetics and they have them on hand, although the prosthetics are particular to the actors that are being involved, they still know how to make them for anybody. So, you know, there does exist a possibility that they can use them on a more regular basis. And, you know, I'd certainly like to see more stories with them than, you know, I don't know, the other prosthetic work that they have for, say, the Slovene. I mean, how many times have they been reused simply because they had the costumes lying around, really?
Yeah.
So it'd be great to see them back. So, you know, a good episode. I mean, I think, again, giving it sort of two ratings, I think it's probably a 4.5 overall for the entire story, you know, just
as a whole.
For a new series episode, mm-hmm. for people who have just joined Doctor Who, I think that this is probably something that plays higher for them. You know, for me as a Doctor Who fan, I'd have to go down on where I was from last week and really say it's probably only 3.5. But that might be subject to some revision if indeed the bits at the end of the episode are worked out. Now, you know, I have to say, earlier in the season, we had, you know, Flesh and Stone, where everybody was up in arms. Not everybody, but a lot of people were up in arms about the last 5 minutes and saying, oh, that's just a terrible last 5 minutes. I can't believe that they did that. It's totally useless. It doesn't make any sense. Totally out of character. And I have to say that for me, I didn't understand that at the time because that was fine for me. But this last 5 minutes was, I now understand the feelings that people were having. Because it really does not sit well with me. I mean, it's got the potential for being resolved in the same way that I think that a lot of people who were initially disgusted by that last 5 minutes of Flesh and Stone have gradually been brought along to understand it because, you know, we got the Venice story and we got Amy's choice afterwards that did make some more sense out of that scene. So it's possible we're going to get some greater sense made out of this last scene. But right now, I really am having a problem with it. So for me, that's why it's down to a 3. And also, a reason I'm dropping a half point off is because of what we were talking about last week, the behind-the-scenes stuff. Again, we have no crediting for the prosthetic department at all, except for Millennium Effects. That's it. Nobody individually is credited, and I'm sorry, but this is one of the better, not one of the best, prosthetic creations that we've had. Yeah. It rubs me the wrong way that that's not there.
It's really a credit to the story. I mean, the actor that played the leader of the Slurrings, the one that was awoken, I thought he... just his eyes, just the looks that he was able to give, and I don't know. I thought they really did a great job with the makeup. Again, it was outstanding. The way they made the differences that they applied to make the difference, so they didn't all look exactly alike. I thought it was.
I know. Well. I thought that was very, very clever. But now here's a trivia question for you, and I don't know the answer to it. Why, if Ian Stuart Black was credited for the Macra in Gridlock? And Kit Pedler and Jerry Davis are credited every time a Cyberman shows up, and Terry Nation is credited every time a Dalek shows up, and Bob Baker is credited every time that K-9 shows up. Why is it that Malcolm Hulk is not credited for the Silurians? Is it that he gave away all rights, or he didn't have rights to them in any way? I don't really understand that, but he's not listed as having been the creator of the Silurians, which I find interesting, but I don't know why that is.
Well, it could have been what you had just said. I think he made it. Maybe he had waived any rights to the characters and, you know, gave it up all to the BBC. I don't know.
I wonder if he would have done that.
Do you know offhand if it's credited at the end of Warriors of the Deep?
Offhand, I don't know. But see, back in those days, they didn't do that. The only
maybe with an exception of Terry Nation.
Well, see, they didn't do things like that. Like technically, every time the Brigadier shows up, it should say, Lincoln and Haseman, because the Brigadier. And every time Nissa shows up, it should say Johnny Byrne, because we know that both of those guys, or all three of those guys, did in fact get residuals out of the use of those companions, those human characters. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's. I could be wrong about this, but I don't think it says every single... No, it doesn't say every time K-9 shows up, Bob Baker, David Martin. So, it wasn't that consistent back in...
In the day.
In the day. I think it's only the Cybermen and the Daleks where it says Daleks created by Terry... It may not even say that, to be honest with you. But I do know that consistently in the new series, you know... We have had these little mentions of who created them because they own a part of the character. And I guess this means that Malcolm Hulk doesn't own a part of the Silurians, but I can't understand the circumstances in which that would have been true. Because I know that Barry Letts did worry about that sort of thing, and he thought it was crazy that Terry Nation was getting so much money out of the Daleks. And that was one of the reasons that he didn't use the Daleks initially. You know, Robert Holmes still invented the Santarans in the Barry Letts era, and still got a cut of that.
It may have to do with the way it's the contracts are written up, you know, and the agreements are signed off.
Well, they did, yeah, but I just don't. I would love to know the story of. Does that mean that in fact the idea for the Silurians is not Malcolm Hulk's, but was Barry Letts, in the same way that Barry Letts and Terrence Dick sort of jointly came up with the Master, but they don't have any rights to it because they were the producers, so therefore they don't have individual creation rights. So I just don't know the story of the Silurian, Doctor Who and the Silurians, and how the actual monsters were created. I'd love to know that particular story because it's bugging me a little bit that I don't know that thing. Anyway.
Maybe if any other of people. Our listeners have anything to shed on it, you know, send us feedback.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, thank you, Darth. I appreciate your input, as always.
I appreciate being here. Thank you very much.
And enjoy tomorrow. Tomorrow is a full day that you can enjoy Memorial Day. Hopefully you're not working and you can take
advantage. Oh, I hope so. I hope so, indeed.
All right. Cheers.
All right. See you later.
All right. Now, you heard us mention Warriors of the Deep. This is a Fifth Doctor story which sees the return of the Silurians and their cousins, the Sea Devils. Now, if you have enjoyed The Hungry Earth and Cold Blood, and you haven't seen Warriors of the Deep, you may want to check it out, or if you have seen it, you may want to revisit it, and you can do it via our sponsor, Audible.com. So you can listen to Warriors of the Deep, the audiobook, while commuting to work, taking the dog out for a walk, taking a bike ride, perhaps drilling into the earth. Well, maybe not that, but... Well, for you, our listeners of Dr. Who Podshock, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. They have lots of selections that you can choose whatever you like for your free selection. But being that we are reviewing The Hungry Earth and in this episode, Cold Blood, it only makes sense that we recommend a story that sees the return after a long absence, after they debut in 1970, the Silurians, and 1972 with the Sea Devils, return in a 1984 Peter Davison story. Peter Davison is the Fifth Doctor. This dramatized audiobook, Warriors of the Deep, stars Peter Davison as the Fifth Doctor. It's the original soundtrack from the 1984 television episode with linking narration by Janet Fielding. The TARDIS materializes inside Sea Base 4, which lies on one of the Earth's ocean beds in the year 2184. The Doctor, Tegan, and Turlough quickly run into trouble as the base personnel suspect them of belonging to an enemy power block. Meanwhile, nearby, a group of Silurians, who inhabited the Earth centuries before mankind, as you know, are reviving some of their Sea Devil cousins after an overlong hibernation. The intention of these combined forces is to attack Sea Base 4 and provoke war between the rival human governments. Check it out, the Sea Devils. Let's hear a little bit from it now.
In the darkness of the deep ocean stands Sea Base 4. Anchored to the seabed by hydraulic legs, its long cylindrical body is built to withstand the immense pressure of the depths. A short tower leads up to the command section, an oblate sphere bristling with antennae that probe the inky waters. Commander Vorjak, a square-jawed man in his 40s, strides onto the busy, brightly lit bridge to join the dour-faced combat marine officer Bulik, who is studying the readout on a wall screen.
What do you think? Too small to be a hunter-killer. Could be one of their probes trying to locate our position. Computer scan.
Sync operator Maddox punches in the command. Out in the forbidding darkness, a sleek green vessel powers through the water, keeping close to the seabed. It is shaped like a snake's head with two huge lights for eyes. The vessel slows and maneuvers to land gently on top of a large rocky outcrop, where it docks with a camouflaged hatch. The interior of the ship is gloomy and organic. Three reptilian bipeds, each with a third eye on their high-crested foreheads, work at control columns that seem to have grown from the floor. The exterior lights are extinguished, and the craft is immediately hidden in the perpetual night of the deep.
No hostile movements registered. Excellent, Skippers. But continue to monitor their activities. They must remain undetected until we are ready to act.
We've lost it, Commander.
On the base, a young, pretty officer called Karina looks up from her console. Vorjak stands behind her with Lieutenant Preston, a woman in her 30s, and the coldly reserved Controller Nielsen.
Readings?
It seems to be organic in structure and radiating heat. Check.
Volcanic debris?
More than possible. We're close to the oceanic fault here.
The screen shows a hazy image of the rocky mound where the reptile's craft lies undetected. In the TARDIS console room, the Doctor makes a few adjustments to the controls and studies the instruments thoughtfully. In his fifth incarnation, he is young-looking, slim, fair-haired, and wearing Edwardian cricketing clothes. Turlough wanders in, knotting his tie.
How are we doing?
Oh, on target, it seems.
The ship is in flight, the time rotor, a translucent column in the center of the console, rising and falling reassuringly.
You changed your mind about going home?
Well, I thought I would learn more if I stayed with you.
It's true. Of course.
I mean it.
I believe you. I'm just a little doubtful about how resolute you'll remain.
Time will tell.
Yes, indeed. Aboard the TARDIS, it always does.
Where are we going?
Earth.
What for?
I promised to show Tegan a little of her planet's future. We're almost there. You could let her know.
Turlough flounces from the room, and the doctor smiles indulgently at the young man's wounded pride. The time rotor comes unexpectedly to rest. The doctor frowns and checks his readings. On Seabase 4, Dvorak is also frowning as he peers at the main screen.
Ah, the marker never looked better. To download your free audiobook today, go to audiblepodcast.com/arttrap. That's ARTTRAP. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/arttrap for your free audiobook. And check out Warriors of the Deep, or pick one of your own selections for your free audiobook. Now let's get back to some cold blood as we continue our review with the return of the Silurians once again in current Doctor Who.
Who speaks for the apes?
Don't tell them what's happened.
I speak for them.
Show me Alea and release her immediately unharmed, or we will kill your friends one by one. Give me back my family! No. Execute the girl.
You want to start a war while the rest of us sleep, Restek?
Unchain them.
I do not recognize your authority at this time, Eldane.
Well, then, you must shoot me.
Rory! You need to get down here. Bring Alea. We hand her over. We can land this after all. All going to work, I promise.
But the moment we get down there, everything will fall apart.
Well, I'd say you've got a fair bit to talk about. You both want the planet. You both have a genuine claim to it.
Is this what happens? The planet gets shared. Is that what we need to do?
What are you talking about?
Oh, Nazarene, sorry. Probably worth mentioning at this stage. Amy and I travel in time a bit.
Anything else?
There are fixed points through time where things must always stay the way they are. This is not one of them. This is an opportunity, a temporal tipping point. Whatever happens today will change future events, create its own timeline, its own reality. The future pivots around you.
Alice. Alice, Dad.
Dad. Where are we?
We're in the center of the Earth, and there are lizardmen.
Elliot. I'm sorry. I took my eye off you.
It's okay. I forgive you.
We lived on the surface of the planet long before you did.
To drain resources.
As I sat there that day across the table from the humans, the future of both species and of our beloved planet Earth rested in our hands.
You provide a place for us on the surface. We'll give you knowledge and technology beyond humanity's dream.
Mom!
Rory!
Something's wrong.
My sister! And you want us to trust these apes, Doctor?
You were building something here. Come on, an alliance could work.
It's too late for that.
Why?
Our drill is set to start burrowing again in 15 minutes.
Executor! Execute all the apes!
Stop right there. I'll use my very deadly weapon again. And one warning, that's all you get. If there can be no deal, you go back into hibernation. All of you, now.
This ends here.
No! It only ends with our victory!
Like I said, one warning.
All right, next in the queue is none other than Russell. Hello, Russell.
Hi, Lewis. How's it going?
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Well, I thought this was an improvement from last week. There's one thing that neither you or Darth have talked about that really kind of irked me right from the beginning. How she pickpocketed the thing to undo her handcuffs.
She was bounded by her wrists. So, of course, yes. She was able to reach into his pocket and grab it.
Sure. Suddenly she's Plastic Man and can just stretch her arms and get in the pocket. I thought that was a little math. I thought that was really off and silly. That was too easy and out.
Well, if she wasn't working as a kissogram and she was doing, you know, if that was her line of work, it's a little bit more understandable, but it just seemed a little, I don't know, far-fetched.
Yeah, because her hand looked pretty clamped down there, and I'm thinking there wasn't a lot of room for movement there. And she was barely just leaned in for like a second, and then she suddenly Houdini. Yeah, apparently she has Houdini powers, and we didn't know about it. So I thought that was a little too easy.
Yeah.
With that, I like the touches of Matt Smith being very Fifth Doctor-ish with the celery and mustache. I thought that was a nice touch in there, and it was nice to have an episode in an alien type setting. If we couldn't leave Earth, at least we had an alien type background.
Yeah, I thought they did that very well, and I agree. I really, you know, I like the nod to you know, the Fifth Doctor there with the celery, and just a nice touch.
Yeah, and I thought it was a well paced episode. I think it was a more exciting one, you know, in a lot of ways than the first one. I thought the first one, like a lot of these two parts, it's just a big setup to say, let's get you here, and here it is.
Yeah, everything was building up to this one, so that first part. You know, the Hungry Earth was all, you know, building up to this.
Yeah, and I thought the actress who played Amber Rose, I mean, you just wanted to reach in the screen and slap her across the face, really, for the stuff she was doing on screen. It just was, talk about, if they wanted to write her as the most idiotic, selfish human they could, then...
Well, that's what the doctor did, too, in a metaphorical way that he, you know, slapped her, you know, in calling, you know, referring to her as, you know, someone that was much, much lesser than the best of humanity and all that. I mean, they did justify her character, why she did it. I mean, she lost her son, she lost her husband, and her father was just infected, and her whole family was, you know, was being taken from her. So the motivation was there, and granted, you know, in hindsight, maybe she thought ill of what she did, but I think they built the character up enough to give her motivation to do what she did.
Yeah, and it really, I mean, I thought the ending, I liked this last 5 minutes a lot better than I liked the last 5 minutes of Flesh and Stone. I mean, I thought Karen Gillan really showed her chops as Amy in just that acting. You know, and I find it kind of funny how they inserted the scene of Rory putting the ring on the console in the previously, yet that wasn't actually in the episode before.
Well, we saw him put the TARDIS. We saw her put the ring in the box and then place it on the TARDIS console in last episode.
We didn't. Okay, I just thought we saw him going back. I didn't know, remember him actually putting.
Yeah, he put it in this
box,
little thing that looked, to me it looked like where the sonic screwdriver came out in the 11th hour. This little thing on the console.
Yeah, a little indent.
And didn't at the end of this episode, didn't the doctor grab the take the ring and hide it or whatever, put it in his coat, or somehow prevented Amy from seeing it?
Yeah, I found it really weird that didn't disappear when he was erased out of existence. And I found it funny watching The Confidential that it sounded from the actor that, oh, yeah, they wrote me out and killed me, and he wasn't really too happy about that. So as much as people are thinking he's coming back, I don't know if he's actually coming back. He seemed kind of miffed that they just wrote him out of the series a little bit to me.
Well, of course, he's not going to leave. He's not going to give you any clues in The Confidential that he's coming back.
Yeah, and I thought The Confidential was weird this week. So it was a mix of the episode and them.
Yeah,
them
I thought if it was up, I know we're not here to review Doctor Who Confidential, but I'll agree with you there. I just felt that it was. I rather, if they were going to, obviously, if those that haven't seen it, the Confidential kind of had a duality this week where the half of it was showing the making of this episode and the other half was on tour with Karen Gillan and Matt Smith on the bus tour. And they kept on going back and forth and it just felt a little, I don't know, jarring. I mean, when I was in the, when they were showing scenes from the making of this episode, the Cold Blood, I was into that, and then all of a sudden we're back on the bus. And then now I'm into the tour, and then now we're back on the Silurian planet, underground, rather. And Maybe if they would have just done one half the show one way and the other half on the tour or whatever, I don't. It just the going back and forth to me felt a little jarring.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody thought, wow, this would be really cool editing it this way, but I don't know. And it felt a little self-patronizing, patting on the back. Oh, look at us, we're touring with the show. And people, you know, it's supposed to be about the episode and not yay for us.
Yeah.
So, I've seen a trend with these confidentials and that.
Oh, Desia steps in now. Chat Sessions just said it looked like they were two stories threaded together. And maybe they could have, but yeah. Maybe they should have done it as two different ones, you know. A half hour one on the tour, and then hopefully a regular full 45 minutes on the episode. You know, just have an extra episode of Confidential.
Yeah, and of all the episodes that needed a good behind the scenes, with all the set design and all the makeup, this one deserved it, really.
Mm.
I mean, all the work that was put into this one, I thought. You know, unless there's a big production in episodes to come, I thought this was one of the better production-wise ones we've seen so far in this series. To me, anyway, I thought it was one of the best-looking ones. Overall, when it comes to the crack, and I don't know what to make of it, really. It refers, you know, it implies that the TARDIS is going to blow up and be smithereens, but we know that really can't happen, or there's not going to be some magic reset button to fix it. So I'm not sure where this is leading to, really, at this point.
Yeah, well, that's the trouble with, you know, when you do stuff like that where you see, you know, the TARDIS destroyed or whatever, you know the series can't continue without it, so... You know, somehow it has going to be a reset, or somehow that's not going to happen, or somehow it's going to be made right. So then, and by having that in the same episode that Rory is gone, that, you know, the death of Rory just, you know, makes you think, well, okay, well, Rory might be coming back too. And I don't know.
Yeah. And it's funny, I didn't see that coming. I know, right up to the point where I saw that one crawl out with a gun, I thought, oh, we're heading for something, but I wasn't sure who was going to get shot. But, you know, it's like that shot in the classic series with the Cyberman shooting the console for Adric. You know, if you see a crawling alien with a gun, that's never really a good sign.
Yeah.
Something's going to get shot somehow.
So how would you rate this story?
I know what. At the time, after I finished it, I was almost close to giving this a 5 because it really was the most enjoyable one I think I've had so far this series. And that ending, just to kind of spin it. This, you think, is just going to wrap it up. They throw that little twist in. You know, I almost give it a 5, but then just the little bits on it that just aren't right. You know, you're in dark disgust, and that her getting out of the cuff, just, I'm going to have to knock it down to a 4.5.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's, half of Darth gave it 4.5, and the other half gave it 3.5. So, and I think I was somewhere in that 4 range as well. And maybe 4.5, maybe the whole story 4. I don't know. I just, as I said, there were certain elements of the story which I would have done a little bit differently, but it was still a very enjoyable, by no means a bad episode. It was still very enjoyable.
No. And another one where the second was definitely better than the first. So,
all right. Well, thank you again, Russell.
Oh, a pleasure, Lewis. Enjoy your Memorial Day weekend.
Yes.
We had our holiday weekend last weekend in Canada.
Russell, please let me know why. Let us know, rather. Why is the Space Channel delayed Doctor Who this week? Was it hockey?
Hockey.
It's the middle of May.
No, it's not hockey. You know what? I would bet it boils down to North American viewing rights.
Oh.
Wouldn't surprise me.
You think it's solely because they're trying to stay in step with BBC America, Space Channel?
Wouldn't surprise me. The BBC made a deal with both space and sci-fi, saying you can only show these episodes.
No, it's not sci-fi. It's BBC America in the U.S.
BBC America, but you can only show these episodes on the same weekend. One cannot get ahead of the other. They have to be simultaneous North American premieres. Wouldn't surprise me if they made that kind of rule.
But do you follow Space Channel? Was there some sort of something going on that they put in its place?
They just reran an earlier episode.
Oh, well, that's, yeah. I thought maybe they put something on special as an excuse, you know, whatever. But just
vampires in Venice.
Oh, all right. Well, that's lame. All right.
Yeah, but it wouldn't surprise me if that. I'm sure space doesn't like that. I'm sure they were going darn it. But that's all they ran.
All right. Well, again, thank you, Russell. And I appreciate your input on that.
Oh, no problem. That's what I'm here for.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers.
Mike Duran, who's a Canadian correspondent, chimed in saying that the Doctor Who was preempted last week on space for Tin Man. They played Tin Man, which is probably the same TV movie that the Sci-Fi Channel had a couple years ago, I'm guessing. I don't know. We're going to get to the rest of the queue, which next in line is Mr. Tim Drury. Hi, Tim. Or should I say good evening there?
Oh, yes, it's very much evening or night. Pitch black outside now.
How's the weather? Enjoying the weather there in where you are?
It's hit and miss here, Lou. So I was in London yesterday to go to an event, and it was too hot in the building, so people were heading outside where it was light rain and quite chilly. And then today, when I'm not at day two of the same event, nice and hot and sunny. Oh, well. It's always the way, isn't it? I have to start with the guest star, Stephen Moore, who I think he gets my prize for being best guest star of the season so far.
He was the actor that played the leader of the Silurians, the one that was awoken.
Yeah, his voice was throwing some people last night because I was putting my show together and gathering some comments off Twitter, and some people were going, "Is that Jim Broadbent?" Which is exactly what I thought when I first heard his voice. Thought of a way of describing the words "squeaky bum time" without having to swear. in the final few minutes, they're rushing away, and then they go, "Oh, we've only got 6 minutes," and we've got this, "Oh, yes, squeaky bum time." And then someone else says something urgent to me. He said, "Yeah, yes, really squeaky bum time." And I thought, "What is this squeaky?" And I thought, and having rewatched it and discussed it with a friend over IM, I think the non-swear box method of saying it is a brown trousers moment.
Oh, well,
because
it had to do with a lot of running around. Maybe if you're not well oiled, you might squeak.
That's another take on it. Everyone's going to have a take on that one, I think. But it threw me last night when I was watching the episode as it went out. I thought, wow, what is that phrase? It's a wonderfully good piece of eccentric language, and there was some nice, great doctorish moments in this episode, especially near the end with the crack. I could imagine several of the previous incarnations of the Doctor running over to that crack and getting all excited and wanting to investigate it, and then getting confronted by their companions for doing so. We still haven't seen enough of the inside of the TARDIS, but we can continue constructing our maps of it, because we know that the sick bay is head in, turn left, and then left again.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that they found it so easily. I figured when they ran into the TARDIS, you would still see some of them like, "Where did you say to go?" But they found it.
Well, we're only days away now from the first of Doctor Who, the adventure games, aren't we? That's early June, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the only thing I know about the TARDIS in the adventure games is that when they did the set design, they showed the people around who were making the adventure games, and these sort of walkways that disappear off to places. Apparently, at least one of them is used, and you get to walk through that door into another room. But I don't know if it's in the first game or not.
I can't.
I noticed the scene where they sort of turn the wrong corner, and Amy and I can't remember the other character's name. When they've just stolen the
Mo, the father.
Where they've just stolen the. Yeah, well, they've just where they've just stolen the guns and they're running away and trying to find their way out, and they sort of like turn the wrong corner and end up in a cavern full of dormant Silurians. As soon as I saw that last night, I thought, Planet of the Daleks. It nicked it entirely from the frozen Daleks.
Well, okay, as I said, there's a lot of familiar
Chris
elements.
Chris Chibnall is a long-term Doctor Who fan, and so it's not that surprising that he puts these things in. I like the celery moment too, because I've noticed that as we've seen more and more episodes, it's clear that we've got an actor who's definitely got his own take on the Doctor, but now and again, you get the feeling that he has not just watched Troughton stories, because we had the mention of celery, and I thought, well, he's definitely certainly at very least the scriptwriter has picked that up off the Fifth Doctor.
Yeah, it may have well just been in the script. I think Matt Smith did an excellent delivery of it, but I'm not sure if he inserted it in himself. I don't know if it was an ad lib. I'm assuming it was in the script.
I'm trying to think what else. I've got a piece of paper, but the trouble with this episode is it was too damn gripping. And I had this piece of paper and I was going to write stuff down, and in the end I haven't written that much stuff down because I got sucked into the plot. Set design and the way they've used the mixture of locations, sets, and sort of a mixture of dressing up locations and using sets back at Upper Boat Studios to create this seamless city underground. I thought it was extremely well achieved. You could believe it was an actual place. It all did seem to sort of flow along. And it was fascinating when they do the confidential and they say that they basically went to the local equivalent of Kew Gardens, hothouse type thing and loads of plants everywhere.
I think they did a very good job. I said that in my piece in the beginning. I thought the set design and the atmosphere and the environment they created for the underground worked very well.
Well, they said on the confidential that they've worked very hard on the lighting to get a particular
They were shooting it from below and nice use of gold lights and it just because usually in underground you get these harsh lighting in other works that we've seen in the past, but here you had some warming, like what you would normally see above ground, some warm lights and glowing lights, and I thought it added to it.
I didn't dislike the narration, but I have to agree with people that it's a bit odd to do that sort of thing in a two-parter.
It just seemed unneeded. It's not that I disliked it. I just felt it was unnecessary.
When we had the narration last, it was in End of Time, and it was in both episodes, and so it kind of flowed along that this was the way it was done.
It seemed out of place.
It will jar slightly, because when the box set comes out, I'll be trying to watch parts one and two back to back when it comes to two-parters, and it will seem a bit of a change of tone.
I thought it was a change now, even a week apart. It just seemed, it's like, why are we getting a narration at the beginning, at the top of the episode? It just seemed out of place. I mean, I think the narration was well done. It just didn't seem necessary.
Yeah. It's worth throwing in that the Silurians are probably painted as a race here even better than they've ever been painted before. There's this wonderfully different, contrasting set of characters where you have people that are clearly sort of bred to just be soldiers, and the scientist who's dedicated to his work and learning about the humans, and he's been at it, not hibernating and educating himself for 300 years. And it all worked really well on that front. They've always been portrayed in Doctor Who as something far more than just a monster. And it's good to see that tradition continuing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I was very sad that they killed off Rory. I thought it was a bit unfair on a character who is just coming into his flow.
Yeah, I thought he really came into his episode. Yeah, in this story, and now he's gone. So we are led to believe.
But the ending last night where he'd reached into the crack and found this
piece.
Piece of TARDIS. Mm-hmm. And so.
Well, maybe it wasn't the TARDIS. Maybe it was just a British police telephone call box.
Well, yeah, it could be. Because I mean, it's a very accurate model of a certain kind of police box. Mm-hmm. I wasn't on last week's show. I'll point out something I pointed out when we did our Colton Collective last week, and that's that Doctor Who doesn't appear to exist in the universe that Stephen Moffat has created here, because.
In the television program?
Yes, because we notice when this police box shows up, nobody says, "Why have you got a TARDIS?"
Well, yeah.
And they don't even say, "Why have you got a police box?" They just suddenly go, "Oh, is it some kind of mobile crime
lab?"
If that was a world where Doctor Who existed...
Well, of course Doctor Who doesn't exist. Despite the Sylvester McCoy story where you see it on, you know, coming on television at the, you know, during the 25th anniversary year, despite that, we'll put that aside, the television show doesn't exist in the Doctor Who universe. And it's... you know, as far as the police box goes, it's history now, especially for the young boy who first sees it, Elliot, and his mother. I mean, why would they? I mean, police boxes went out so long ago, and since Doctor Who doesn't exist, they don't have a weekly television series that reminds everyone of their existence. They would just assume it was a crime lab. Why not?
To return briefly to the death of Rory, I thought it was very well handled, where the Doctor's trying to get Amy to keep remembering him, because where they cut to all these flashbacks and you see some, there was at least one that didn't actually appear to be from an episode that I could remember, where he's walking along and he suddenly stumbles over. I couldn't place that particular bit.
Yeah, I think there probably were some cutscenes.
It was very cleverly handled, the way these clips seem to be sort of fading away, as if her memories are going. And then there's that sudden jolt, and she's lost concentration, and it's all gone. And things are afoot now. They aren't. It's clear that. Stephen Moffat's very aware that we Doctor Who fans like to discuss things amongst ourselves, and so he's intent on getting everybody speculating between now and the finale, I think.
Of course. So, how would you rate this story?
I have, unevenly. Part one I gave 4 out of 5 to, because I enjoyed it, but it was mostly set up. But part two, I thought, was absolutely brilliant, and 5 out of 5, because it was gripping. You just couldn't take your eyes off it. It was wonderfully entertaining piece of television. And, I look forward to next week, because it seems we're going to a sort of single-parter, a bit more of a fun episode next time.
Yeah, Van Gogh, yes. All right, Tim. Well, thank you once again. It's always good to get your take on things. No pun intended. Well, okay, slight pun intended. All right. Thank you again, Tim.
Absolutely.
Cheers. All right. Well, next in the queue is Mr. Charlie79, Charlie P. Hello there, Charlie.
Hello, Lewis.
How's it going?
All right. Yeah, I like this one slightly. I mean, or yeah, slightly more than
the previous.
The last part in Hungry Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still the whole voiceover thing. I'm still on the fence about that because there was that bit with when the voiceover kicked in during the whole negotiations scene with Nazarene was talking and I, there was part of me thinking I want to hear what she's saying now.
Same here.
And it felt like I'm thinking if that was like a post production decision or if that was part of the original script.
I don't know. It seems to me it was tacked on. I mean, I could be wrong, but it just seems, I don't know. It just didn't seem like it was meant to be there.
This story's lacking. You know, let's get Stephen Moore back in the studio and courts and stuff. I like the guns. They are very Sea Devil-ish looking.
Yes. Yes. That too. It's a good point.
The whole bit with the moon, which I think they took off from the target novelization of Silurians, the cave monsters. And when he explained what happened in that story, he said, there's another tribes that go that the humans killed them off. And I'm thinking, there's more to that story than just humans killed you off. but there's a 7-part story that, that's just, I don't know why they did that, but. Because it kind of, it put the humans in even worse light than they were beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
I like the character of Malachi, it's just that little bit with the doctor and they woke Elliot up. That sort of little bonding scene they had with the fist bump they did together.
Yeah,
and it was one of those things. Oh, what a nice kind of character. And then think about, well, he did dissect Mo, but
yeah, he was about to do the same to Amy.
Yeah, exactly.
You think? Actually, he said he was down there for 300 years. You think by now he would have probably dissected, people that all the people he needed to dissect. What else is more to know?
Well, Reshtok, whatever her name, she said something about you used to hunt them.
Yes.
And so, maybe that's just he had a turn for the good or something. There was that bit with very early on in the beginning of the episode with
Nazarene.
Nazarene, the doctor, Nazarene, and she says something about like, why are these plants growing? And I expected him to explain that, but he didn't do that. I don't know if that was, maybe that's a deleted scene. Along with, also they didn't explain the whole grave robbing thing as well. I like that. Maybe that's on cutting room floor. The whole scene with the Silurians, the whole computer scene, them talking the computer monitor. That was very, I don't want to say Star Trek or very, sort of I don't know, like 24 kind of American TV kind of scene. I didn't understand why the camera moved up. The camera was panning around, pans over the Mo, pans over the A&E, pans over, I need a close-up, I'm going to say execute him.
It seemed a little out of place because it called attention to the camera, where if it was just a static image, it would have been more believable.
When they cut to Rory and everybody else, they've just picked it like a static shot of them just looking. But I did like Matt Smith, that whole bit with Matt Smith talking to them. It felt very, it felt like that scene in Five Doctors with Troughton talking. He's like when he's on the monitor saying, there you are, or there I am. That old scene, that reminded me of that scene. The whole... the whole decontamination scene with the celery scene. I like the whole explanation that's him talking about how he needs the bacteria that for him to survive. I thought that was a good, nice scene. Mm-hmm.
It also establishes for new viewers that he is alien and he does have two hearts and he's not
right. I think that's this is the first time they've addressed that he has two hearts for Matt Smith.
Maybe
they've been in that earlier.
Yeah.
But so, if people new to this show, I like the Silurian theme music that da 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 da. I like that. They play that quite a bit. Again, poor Rory. I liked Rory. I don't know if we'll ever see him again. I know they're releasing three BBC books in September, and Rory's on the cover of them. I don't know if that has to do anything with it or not.
Yeah, unless there are adventures that take place somehow sliced in between the ones that we've just seen.
Oh, okay.
Perhaps, I don't know.
Because there was that deleted scene in Hungry Earth where Amy said they'd been traveling for months. But I don't know if that has to do with it. So yeah, probably like I said, this part would probably be about a 4.5. Last part would probably be a 4. So yeah.
All right.
Overall, very good.
Well, thank you again, Charlie. As always, I appreciate your input.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, cheers, and have a happy Memorial Day if you're celebrating it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Too. Cheers. All right, I think this might be Ken might have joined us while we were talking. Ken, is that you?
Hello.
Hi, Ken. How are you doing?
Howdy. Doing all right. How are you?
I'm glad you were able to chime in.
Yes, I just got in, so I'm here in the midst of Memorial Weekend here in the United States, and keeping in mind that it's not a holiday for barbecues and pool parties, that it actually has some real significance to it. So, all that goodness. So, we're talking about
Cold Blood.
Doctor Who. Yeah. Fantastic. Really enjoyed it. It was a solid follow-up to last week, which was an episode I really enjoyed. And I think I gave part one 5 TARDIS groans, and I'm giving part 2 5 TARDIS groans. I put them all together. I just had probably the closest to an episode with the closest feel to a classic episode that we've had so far. Where it felt like you were watching a story from the classic era.
It did very much have that feel to it through the whole thing.
Make what you will of it. Some people would say, well, that's terrible. Who wants that? And then other people like myself will say, oh, that was great. The pacing and the concepts. They didn't try to be too highbrow about some things. They just kind of let it be a monster story. And I think there was an opportunity there to flip some preconceptions over. There was this thought that it would be the humans that would try to destroy the Silurians, and then it looked like maybe the Silurians were going to be the ones who would be the aggressors and give a justification for the humans to react and things like that. I liked the development of the Silurians, the way they were in the classic 3 stories. The Beneath the Sea stories, where they're not just monsters. They have a very developed society, similar to the classic Planet of the Apes movie, where there are intellectuals and soldiers and all different walks of life, but just in a different race. And so you couldn't just pin them and say, oh, here comes some terrible monsters coming down here to...
Yeah, and they're not all the same. Some are more aggressive, and some are more pacifistic. I'm sure.
I love the idea that there was a power play going on there between the military and the gentry of
the Silurian race.
And it mirrored the humans as well, because obviously, you know, one human wasn't representative of the whole race.
Yes. I thought it was very powerful as well when the humans show up with the body of a dead Silurian, and it's they're just, they've got this shroud on the body, which in from an artistic point of view seemed to be more powerful than I actually found it to be less powerful when they showed her face and that she was dead. I thought it was more powerful when you just saw the person walking in,
mm-hmm.
and you knew the body was under that wrap. So I found that to be very
powerful.
Well,
they didn't even have to show the face. They could have just had the reaction of her sister, Aaliyah's sister, who then, you know, mourns her. And, you know, they could have just showed her without even showing the Aaliyah's face in the shroud.
But it was everything that I enjoy in a Doctor Who episode. And I know that there are some people who are not going to enjoy certain ways, certain things in the episode, certain issues with the way things were done, but it's, for me, it's after the last two stories with Vampires in Venice, which was not really where my type of story, and in particular Amy's Choice, which I'm one of the few people I think that didn't like that story. This, to me, was a return to classic Doctor Who. We're back with monsters and running up and down halls and
explosions.
And explosions. So great, bring it on. I love it. I was one of those people who loves Warriors of the Deep. It's one of the most maligned stories in Doctor Who canon, and yet it's a favorite of mine. So,
well, I think most people will just get hung up with the marker and how that was executed.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if people just look past that, you know.
The story is fantastic.
Yeah.
So it's a well-executed base under siege story, again with Silurians, where this is the one of the members of the Triad, and he's a smart man, but a smart creature, but he's made a intellectual decision to let human beings fight out a war to clear the planet off. And these are not simple concepts. They're not your basic monster tries to eat city kind of concept.
Yeah.
You know, There's some thought behind it. There's some depth behind it. So that's pretty much it. I don't want to keep going on about it. I just simply enjoyed it. And to me, there's not much more to analyze. I think there's been a tendency to really, really start digging in and saying. I mean, there were some little things, like any story, that a pet peeve of mine is a video screen that zooms in.
Yeah, we were just talking
huge
about that.
Huge pet peeve of mine.
Yeah.
I just. They've done it in Star Trek. They've done it in Doctor Who. They've done it in all kinds of places where you're watching somebody on the screen, and then for some reason a security camera decides it wants to zoom in at the most dramatic point. What software are you using? I'm using the new Stanley Kubrick software, which zooms in on a dramatic point. It doesn't, you know, it just seems a little.
Emo cam.
If you want to nitpick about something, that to me is something to nitpick about. But it's certainly not going to drive a story from being a good, fun.
Yeah,
Doctor
yeah.
Who
I
story
thought
to,
the same
to,
thing.
To
I thought it was a good story. I had a lot of fun with it, but there was a few nitpicks that I picked out on it. But overall, it didn't take away from my enjoyment of the story.
And you know, it seems like almost the right type of story. Last weekend and this weekend, both in the UK and the US. Where suddenly it's summer, you know, summer really has arrived, the warm weather and all that kind of stuff. So there wasn't this really heavy-handed story. It's just a fun action-adventure type of story.
Well, I think next week is going to be another, you know, light-handed, you know, not a heavy story. We'll see.
Well, we're heading into the season finale, and we're heading into what will probably be some very heavy
well,
stuff.
Well, yeah, I think we're going to get the Quiet Before the Storm, though. You know, Van Gogh and all that. We'll see.
They must really feel very strongly about this story coming up next week to keep this type of story so late in the season.
Or, you know, or as I said, it could be the little, you know, lull before the big thing comes, you know.
Yeah.
And pardon me because I joined in late, but was James here today?
James is out celebrating Memorial Day weekend in the UK. No, I don't know where James is. He's MIA. So I want to thank everyone that took part in today's show. I'm glad Ken was able to join us before we closed out the show. Those in the U.S. that are listening live right now, enjoy the holiday, and those elsewhere, enjoy your day as well. And as Ken said, you know, it's more than just a day about barbecues and swimming pools and beaches. It's let's remember what it's all about.
Yeah, there are many people, whether they're here in the United States or around the world, and for wherever you may be coming from, there are people who choose to serve and to serve their country because they think it's the right thing to do to help other people. And for those people, we want to say thank you.
All righty. Well, I hope everyone joins us next time. And until then, cheers, everyone. Hey, but wait, that's just our live show. We got more show coming to you right now. We have, as always, we have our Doctor Who Podchuck public call box open for those that don't make it into the live show that want to send us feedback on a particular episode that we are reviewing. And we have a couple of those coming up. But first, I want to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors, Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy. With stores in Austin and San Antonio, Texas, and now a new store in Bellevue, Washington, they sell Doctor Who action figures, CDs, and comics. They also sell board games, role-playing games, card games, graphic novels, Magna, and a whole lot more. Check out their website at dlayer.net. That's D as in dragon, layer, that's LAIR.net, N-E-T. And with the Gallifreyan Embassy celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy is celebrating their 24th anniversary. They're right on our heels. So we wish them well, and we hope that you show them your support by visiting them in person in Austin or San Antonio, Texas, or their new store in Bellevue, Washington. Or go to their website, as always, it's dlayer.net. Give them a call at 512-454-2399. Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy. You may have seen on the feeds, we just released a Doctor Who Podchuck Extra Edition, number 205. It includes a Doctor Who discussion panel we did just a week prior to the new series starting, so you can tap into what Doctor Who fandom was like and what the anticipation was like for the new series and see where we were right and maybe where we were not right. But it was more than that. It was covering all Doctor Who as well, so it's a good listen. Doctor Who Podchuck 205, the extra edition. For a low monthly subscription fee, as a show of support, not only will you be helping us continue and grow the show, but you'll get extra content as well, just like that episode. To become a Podchuck supporting subscriber, go to our website, gallifreyanembassy.org or podchuck.net, and click on the Podchuck supporting subscriber banner up on the top. And if you're already a Podchuck supporting subscriber, thank you for your continued support. We could not do this show without your help. So let's go into the Podchuck public call box and our feedback. And first up is our correspondent in Germany, none other than Graham Sheridan. And this is his take on Cold Blood.
Hello, it's Graham, the second Dr. Sheridan, here once again. Here's my little bit of thought about Cold Blood. Well, as far as the second part goes, it wasn't too much of a letdown, really. Well, until the end. Was that really, really, really necessary? I mean, it was bad enough that we had in the dream sequence from Amy's choice that Rory dies there. But again? What are they doing? He's not Adric. Seriously, he's not Adric. Rory's not Adric. We like Rory. But otherwise, the realms were really well realised, the underground part. The makeup was absolutely fantastic, and I mean fantastic. Excellent work done there. Okay, there's a few complaints out there. Where's the missing eye? What, the third eye and that? For anybody who's watched previous Silurian adventures, they always had this third eye. I myself don't miss it at all. They're another tribe. You know, do I look the same as somebody that comes out of China, for instance? No, I don't. Do I look the same as somebody comes out of Africa? No, I don't. And reflecting this with the Silurians, I found was a really good idea. I enjoyed the performances of the scientist and of the actual leader of the Silurians. And it was a really, really good performance by the actors there. Matt Smith's performance just gets better and better and better. You wonder how that's possible. I do each week, but he seems to really, really hit the mark. And he seems to be a doctor. Well, the doctor to me now seems to be one of... he realises he's making mistakes all over the place, and he's not liking it. So he knows he puts this on the list. Mira Sayle, the geologist, puts in a solid performance all the way through, and... brings back the sparkle, the enigmatic spark, the sort of the innocence and the excited feeling that most people would, or I'd expect, would have by experiencing something like this. The only niggle I have is the way that the humans, or better said, the mother of the of Elliot. I understand that a mother has strong protective feelings. But there was... hang on. You managed to kill this Silurian with an electroshocker. Really? And okay, I had the idea from the first episode that she was actually looking at the electroshocker in the first place. And, well, it was hinted by the Silurian herself. I know which one of you is going to kill me. But all the same... It was... This bit really niggled me. I mean, I really have been enjoying the series so far, but this is one of two points in this episode that really niggled me. And I'm sure they're going out there for the shock factor. There's no doubt about that. They've got to have a little bit of a shock, but this is where the high quality of the script so far just gets let down completely. But otherwise, still a good story. The points I didn't like, which I've mentioned, I didn't like that Rory gets killed off, but I have the feeling we'll see Rory once again at the end, and maybe in the last two episodes, who knows, but I do have this feeling that it will do. Karen Gillan's performance, she's put back into the end of, well, towards the end of Amy's choice again, and there's nothing to fault there. So, compared with the first part, I really like the first part. The first part for me of this was a definite 5 out of 5 without even have to think about it. This was a letdown for me. It really was. I was very disappointed in the way that it worked out, though I'm going to have to watch it about 3 or 4 times again to catch all the details. And the only thing that sort of really brought up the end of the story for me was the bit of TARDIS that the Doctor managed to pull out of the crack. So we'll see what the next episode brings, and hopefully I should make it onto the coming Podshock on Sunday. See you then.
Thank you, Graham, and you did make it. That's coming up in a future episode of Doctor Who Podshock. Thank you once again, Graham. And as far as the Third Eye goes, you know, it's just like the Sea Devils was the cousins of the Silurians. I think there are various different species of, well, maybe not species, but races of Silurians, perhaps, or Homo erectus or Reptilia, whatever it's called. So, you know, perhaps similar to, like, birds, you know, there's, you know, the planet is inhabited by birds, but there's so many different types of birds out there, and very and they can look drastically different. You know, compare a penguin to an ostrich, or you know, or, and then compare that to a regular sparrow. You know, there are certain basic traits that are there, but they could look vastly different, you know, on the surface. So yeah, I think the Silurians that we saw in the past and the Silurians that we see today can come from a time of planet Earth when they all were on the surface and they were all coexisting with each other as birds do in the sky today. Well, not all of them in the sky. You don't see penguins flying. Well, maybe you do, but they're just jumping from one little iceberg to another. All right, well, we have a last piece of feedback here coming in to the Podchuck public call box. And just to remind you, you can send in your feedback to us by calling 206-600-6517 is our number. And it's the Podchuck public call box. It's a 206 area code, and I believe that's in Washington State. So just be aware of that. So, but most people are, you know, have these minutes on their, you know, smartphones or cell phones or mobile phones, whatever you want to call them, or Skype. You can call out through Skype as well and leave. You can also leave us feedback directly on Skype. The thing is, you know, we're paying for this service. You know, I'm a little frustrated because many times we go to collect our messages and they're not there. They're, I mean, they're there, but they're just not playing back. It's very frustrating. Skype, get with it. We're paying for this. All right, you can also email your feedback to feedback@podshock.net. Now, this is an audio podcast, so we always prefer audio feedback. So if you do have one of those smartphones, or even if you have a dumb phone, if you can record on it, or even use your computer recorder on it, make an MP3 file or whatever, and send it to feedback@podshock.net. That's feedback@podshock.net. So last but definitely not least is Brent from North Carolina on Doctor Who, Cold Blood.
Hey guys, this is Brent from Raleigh, North Carolina. Again, just thought I'd call in and give a quick little review of the Hungry Earth and Cold Blood two-parter. Overall, I thought it was awesome. I thought it was excellent, as most of the year has been this year. A lot of people on other podcasts that I've listened to, they, a lot of them are trying to squeeze in past Doctors into Matt Smith's performance, and I try to stay away from that, but in this two-part, I couldn't help but see John Pertwee in a lot of what he was doing, and a little of Peter Davison here and there, but it was, I think that was may have been done on purpose, but it really reminded me of an old four-parter, and I really liked it. And the ending, I didn't see that one coming. I thought after the whole thing with Amy thinking that Roy was dead in Amy's choice, you know, and then they turn around and they really kill him. That was totally unexpected. And one of my boys, when it happened, he totally like took his hand and slapped it on his mouth and was like, like, because I showed him a few Adric stories, and then the one where Adric died like a few months ago, and he was devastated. So, you know, here it is again, although Roy hasn't been on there very long, but still he was like, man, I can't believe is he really dead? Is he really dead? And then at the end, I'm assuming from what I saw that the reason for the crack in time that they keep seeing is because the TARDIS is going to blow up. And then I said, well, maybe some of the things that have happened this year won't happen once they get to that part and fix whatever is that's wrong. I don't know. Who knows? I guess we'll see. But yeah, just excellent, excellent episode. Made my hair stand up at the end when he saw that it was a piece of the TARDIS. That was just really awesome. Anyway, talk to you next week. See ya.
Thank you, Brent. And I do agree, and so does Ken, as you heard previously on this episode, that this Doctor Who story, Cold Blood, and the episode before that, The Hungry Earth, did have a feel of past Doctor Who serials in like the John Pertwee era. And I think that was a good thing. It was very familiar, but not, you know, too familiar, but it was very familiar. And it was comforting, actually, you know, at least I felt it. And it was kind of neat. As far as Rory goes, well, we'll have to see what happens there. I don't, you know, I just was beginning to warm up to Rory. Not that I disliked him in any way. It's just that I was just getting to know him. We only had a couple episodes really with him. And, you know, but I had this feeling when, you know, Rory was introduced that he was not going to be in the whole series. I just knew it, you know, just like Adam, just like we had with Captain Jack. They're in there for a few episodes, and for some reason it's the Doctor and a female companion, and any time since 2005, since the series has come back, anytime there's a male companion, they only stick around for a few episodes, if that much. We need a full-fledged male companion. You know, in addition to a female companion, whatever, we can. It's worked before, it can work again. Isn't that right, Jamie? Well, Fraser Hines says yes. So that's going to round out this show, and forgive the lateness or the tardiness of this episode. It's been a very busy week, and we're trying to catch up. We have our review of Vincent and the Doctor coming up, but before that, we have our live show that we recorded in New York City a couple weeks ago, and that's coming up next after this episode. So stay tuned. We got plenty more Dr. U Podchak coming up. As always, we thank our Podchak supporting subscribers for making it all happen. And in between Doctor Who Podchak episodes, or even during Doctor Who Podchak episodes, you can visit our website, thegallifreyanembassy.org or podchak.net. Both URLs will get you to the same place. It's the home website of Doctor Who Podchak. So we have forums, we have polls, we have all sorts of stuff, an active community there to participate in. So if you want to further discuss the Cold Blood episode, or Vincent and the Doctor, or perhaps you want to discuss City of Death, or perhaps you want to discuss the original Silurians, Doctor Who and the Silurians, whatever, you can discuss it on our website, thegallifreyanembassy.org or podchak.net. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/podchak. You can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/LewisTrapani. So until next time, cheers, everyone. You have been listening to Doctor Who Podchak, presented by the fan-run GallifreyanEmbassy.org. Doctor Who is owned and trademarked by the BBC. Doctor Who Podchak is not affiliated with the BBC in any way. Come back next time for another exciting and informative episode of Doctor Who Podchak. Doctor Who Podchak theme music by Jeff Smith at thejeffsmith.com. This has been a production of Art Trap Productions and is presented to you by the Gallifreyan Embassy and has been made possible in part by supporting subscribers and donations from listeners like you. Hey, this is the part of the episode that we usually play a little short clip from the episode that we are reviewing, but in post-production I realized that we didn't play the third montage of clips from the episode that Dave A.C. Cooper puts together for us, so we're going to close the show with that instead. And thank you once again, Dave A.C., for your hard work in putting these clips together for our review shows.
So, question is, how do we stop the drill given that we can't get there on time? Plus, also, how do we get out given that we're surrounded? Nazarene, how do you feel about an energy pulse channeled up through the tunnels to the base of the drill?
Going to cave in all the surrounding tunnels, so we have to be out and on the surface by then.
But we can't get past Restak's troops.
I can help with that. Toxic fumigation. Then the city shuts down.
Here's a deal. Everybody listening. Eldaine, you activate shutdown. I'll amend the system. Set your alarm for 1,000 years' time. 1,000 years to sort the planet out. To be ready. Pass it on.
All of you, go!
Well, we're not leaving you here.
Run, Dad!
8 minutes, 10 seconds.
I'm not coming either.
Not here. Not now.
It's getting wider.
4 minutes 50, we have to go.
The angels laugh when I didn't know. Prisoner Zero knew. Everybody knows, except me.
Doctor, just leave it.
But where there's an explosion, there's shrapnel.
Doctor!
Okay, get in the TARDIS, both of you.
You did this!
Doctor!
Rory, can you hear me?
I don't understand.
Don't talk. Doctor, is he okay? We have to get him onto the TARDIS.
We were on the hill. I can't die here.
Don't say that.
We were so beautiful.
Doctor, help him.
If time energy catches up with you, you'll never have been born. It will erase every moment of your existence. You will never have lived at all.
Amy, move away from the light. If it touches you, you'll be wiped from history.
Doctor, we can't just leave.
Keep him in your mind. Don't forget him. If you forget him, you'll lose him forever.
No way on the Byzantium. I still remember the clerics because I am a time traveler now. You said
they weren't part of your world. This is different. This is your own history changing.
Don't tell me it's going to be okay. You have to make it okay.
It's going to be hard, but you can do it. Amen.
You're very quiet. Oh, hey, look. There I am again. Hello, me!
Now, as my people awaken from their thousand-year sleep, ready to rise to the surface, my thoughts turn back to the Doctor, the losses he suffered them, and the greater losses that were still to come.